The recent Bali summit between U.S. President Joe Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping underscored two things about the U.S.-China relationship as we near the end of the year 2022. First, that many of the differences between the United States and China are, in the end, irreconcilable. And second, that notwithstanding that, both sides have a stated desire to restore some level of functionality and constructiveness to this deeply strained but vitally consequential bilateral relationship. Prominent on the agenda for this first in-person meeting between the two presidents was the issue of Taiwan, which has been a source of significantly increased tensions in the relationship between the United States and China in recent years and months. What is the current state of play with respect to Taiwan? Does the summit or the recently concluded political transitions in the two countries change the trajectory in any discernible or meaningful way? Where does U.S. policy toward Taiwan stand at this point? What is the risk of conflagration across the Taiwan Strait? My name is David Feierstein, and welcome to the Bush China Foundation podcast. Joining me today to explore these questions is Dr. Bob Wong, Senior Associate with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, or CSIS, and Adjunct Professor at the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. Bob, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, David. It's my pleasure. I think these are really important questions that you've asked, and I'm glad to share my views, although some of them may be controversial.
Well, we really appreciate your being with us. Dr. Wong was a career Foreign Service officer in the U.S. Department of State from 1984 to 2016. He last served as the U.S. senior official for APEC, or the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Organization, from 2013 to 2015, and as the deputy chief of mission at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing from 2011 to 2013. Dr. Wong also served as deputy director of the American Institute in Taiwan from 2006 to 2009, and in a variety of diplomatic and policy roles abroad and in Washington in the course of his distinguished career. Bob, let's start at the big picture level in terms of the U.S.-China relationship. With the Biden-Xi summit now behind us, what is your take on where the relationship is now and where it's going? And to what degree do the recently concluded Chinese and U.S. political transitions bear on the direction of the relationship over the near term?
Yes, I think I would repeat what you actually said earlier, which is that I think a lot of the these issues are in fact irreconcilable, at least at this point. So frankly, I don't think that much has changed after the summit or the two various Congress and midterm elections. So I think our bilateral relationship has, in fact, going to be increasingly tense as we continue, as the U.S. begins to and has begun actually to respond more forcefully on a range of issues from China's trade policies, massive IPR violations, coercive actions in the South China Sea against Taiwan as well more recently. And finally, I think more recently, a lot of people are paying attention on China's gross human rights violations against political dissidents on the mainland and in Hong Kong, and of course, against the ethnic minorities in both Xinjiang and Tibet. So these are becoming really, I think, very, very key issues for us. And I think we're responding to it, which accounts for the increasingly tense, I think, relationship. And so far, it seems to me, at least, that there is no indication that Beijing, at least at this point, is prepared to alter any of these policies and may, in fact, double down on them in Xi Jinping's third term. And I also don't see the results of the midterm elections as changing U.S. views and responses to China, as these have been laid out, for example, in Biden's national security strategy that was released in October. So the future of our bilateral relationship, I think, looks pretty bleak at this moment. Although, as you mentioned, I think it's very good that the two leaders met in Bali because it opens up a channel of communication and maybe sets a floor, as people from the NSC have commented. But I think in the end, I think what we need are actions and not words to actually try to address and resolve a lot of these bilateral and multilateral issues as well.
Bob, just picking up on this point about how the two political processes probably you know, don't have a very significant bearing on the overall direction of the relationship. Was there anything coming out of the 20th Party Congress in China that recently concluded that surprised you with respect to China's views on Taiwan specifically, or the broader relationship between China and the United States? Or is the overall takeaway one of basically policy continuity?
No, I think it went pretty much as expected, reflecting Xi Jinping's increasing control of the party, which is likely to, of course, mean policy continuity, as you mentioned, or even the hardening of China's current policies. So none of the work reports that I saw that came out of the 20th Party Congress suggested any significant changes in Chinese policies. So in some ways, this is disappointing, but at the same time, I think not unexpected by most people, especially as Xi Jinping goes into his third term. But I do want to point out one thing, which is that despite that, I think there are still, in fact, significant policy differences within the party, the Communist Party, and in China, below the surface that we don't really see because of the controlled social media and so on. And in some ways, this was sort of accidentally suggested by Hu Jintao's sort of an unusual exit from the Congress and how that was filmed, in fact, by the people who were watching it. And I think that suggests that there are, in fact, major differences under the surface, and some of them may become more serious. I think Xi Jinping's third term, although he may have 5 years, but any of the problems could arise at any moment.
The recent summit between President Biden and President Xi gives us a good snapshot, I think, of where the Biden administration is on China at this time, based on the comments to reporters after the meeting and so on, and where the administration seems to want to go. Bob, my question for you is, do you personally think the Biden administration is calibrating its approach to China correctly? Or is there anything the administration, in your judgment, should be doing that it's not, or shouldn't be doing that it is? And on a related note, does the level of continuity between the mindsets and policies of the Trump and Biden administrations on China surprise you at all?
Well, in my own opinion, yes, I think Biden's policy is on the right track in general. It seems to me that the Biden administration has now clearly recognized that China under Xi Jinping has become the most powerful global challenge to U.S. interests, but also to U.S. values, as we see it in its national security statement that I referred to before. And, you know, a lot of people who worked now for Biden had worked for President Obama before, and I think have now recognized that there needs to be an adjustment to our previous policies. So in my opinion, I think President Biden now needs to maintain this focus and take further actions to confront this challenge. That is, for example, keeping the Trump tariffs, enacting more effective export controls, and conducting more freedom of navigation operations with our allies in particular, you know, and as well as continuing to highlight and impose sanctions against China for its gross human rights violations, especially in Xinjiang. And you were asking about the differences between the two administrations. I think the level of continuity is not surprising to me, since Beijing has become much bolder and more open in confronting the U.S. and the West with its so-called wolf warrior diplomacy. So it's not shy about it. The difference between the two administrations may be in Biden's more public efforts to try to get our allies to support our policies, which is, of course, important. But I'm not sure how successful this will be. I think we need to lead with our own actions and not wait until everybody gets on board, because, as you know, around the world, to get all these countries on board with their own interests is going to be difficult. So I think Biden needs to do that in the coming years.
Before we delve into the important and very timely topic of Taiwan, and I know you have deep expertise on Taiwan and so many other issues in U.S.-China relations, I wanted to ask you what your take is on where the Chinese economy is today and where it's going, particularly in light of China's COVID zero policy and the major impact that that policy has had on China's economy and society.
Yes, I think statistically, everybody, I think, can see that the growth of the Chinese economy has clearly and significantly slowed over the past few years as a result, of course, of the global pandemic and its own zero COVID policy. But not only that, it's also, I think, as a result of an increasing reversion in the past few years to more state-controlled economic policies, as opposed to the more economic market reform policies that had been in place for the past, 10, 20 years under Deng Xiaoping and Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao. So I think the slowdown is probably going to last longer, not just come back right after the pandemic, because, again, the policies are more long-lasting. And we have to remember one thing, which is that, China is still a middle-income economy. It's not an advanced industrial economy. Its GDP per capita is $16,000 approximately, and it has 1.4 billion people to feed. So I think that slowing down to a growth of maybe 2, 3, 4%, I think would be consequential for the livelihood of the people in China. So I think this has obviously created more internal dissension and policy differences with potential consequences, I think, for China's political stability. And, we can see signs of this even in the heavily controlled social media. But at the same time, let me just point out that it would also be, I think, be a mistake to underestimate the Communist Party's ability to maintain political control, as most Chinese still today want to avoid political instability, which would, of course, have a major impact on their lives and their livelihood. So it's going to take a little bit more time. It's going to take more, perhaps even more serious economic crisis to bring about changes in China's policy. But I suspect that if China's slow growth continues, that at some point there will be a repercussion within Chinese society.
I want to turn to the topic of Taiwan now, and I know this is an issue that you have thought and written about extensively and are very deep on. In the wake of U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan in August and China's response to that visit, what is your overall assessment of the cross-strait picture as we near the end of 2022?
First of all, I would like to say, if I can, that I do see Pelosi's visit as very significant in underscoring U.S. commitment to Taiwan and consistent, I would say, with longstanding U.S. policy, as stated in the Taiwan Relations Act, Six Assurances, and so on, particularly because it's a response, I think, to the increasing Chinese coercive and intimidating actions over the past several years against Taiwan. So there has to be a response to it. And I'm glad that the Biden administration, while initially, I think, a little bit nervous about her visit, eventually came to her support after the visit itself when the Chinese, I think, overreacted, as a lot of people say. But I'm glad that the Biden administration came in to support her visit. But of course, as I think people will observe, cross-strait tensions will increase, as Beijing will continue to test U.S. commitment to Taiwan, through further actions against Taiwan and military actions and political actions as well. Because at this point, at least, inconceivable that China will or Beijing will in any way renounce the use of force against Taiwan. So every time it pushes forward, it's going to increase tension. And of course, if the U.S. does respond, then it's going to increase tensions across the straits.
There's a couple of things to drill down on this topic of Taiwan. So let me follow up with you on a few things. One, in recent months and really over the last couple of years, we've seen an uptick in predictions. I would say even this year, 2022, subsequent to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which we'll touch on a little bit more later, there's been a sharp uptick in predictions on the part of U.S. and other analysts of a direct U.S.-China conflict developing over the issue of Taiwan specifically. Do you see any significant likelihood of an actual U.S.-China military conflict in the Taiwan Strait? Or do you think that the status quo that we've seen for several decades will hold for an indefinite or possibly even long period of time?
In my own opinion, I think that although there will be increased tensions, as I mentioned earlier, it really is unlikely that there will be a major armed conflict across the Taiwan Strait anytime in the near future, because the risk of U.S. involvement, especially underscored by Biden's recent statements and, of course, naval exercises and so on, and the cost of such a conflict would be huge for China. And I think the Chinese leaders are fully aware of the cost and the risk involved in an increasing conflict across the Taiwan Strait. And the way I would see it, I mean, going all the way back to 2,000, 3,000 years of Chinese history, what I would see is essentially Beijing employing what they call Sun Tzu's art of war, Sun Tzu Bingfa, which is essentially trying to win a war without actually fighting it by using tactics of intimidation, coercion, and so on, with the final goal or hoping and expecting that the U.S. and Taiwan will eventually give in. So as they increase their exercises, as they increase their coercion, at some point they are looking for signs that the U.S. will responsibly weaker. And of course, this will send a sign as well to the people in Taiwan. And if that's the case, then Sun Tzu Bingfa, the art of war, will have succeeded, because they will have then have an impact, a political impact, on what happens within Taiwan itself, and hopefully getting some concessions from Taiwan regarding their relationship with China. So that's the way I see it. So I think the status quo at this point will probably continue for some time indefinitely, and with testing on the part of China in particular.
Bob, you mentioned President Biden's recent statement on Taiwan on 60 Minutes, and it was obviously a very significant statement, and I think many would say a departure from really any presidential statement on this topic before. What do you make of President Biden's statement that the United States would send troops to defend Taiwan if China attacked Taiwan? And in light of this clear-cut statement, I mean, it certainly was not a slip of the tongue. It was not a gaffe. It was very clearly stated. How can the United States at this point credibly maintain, as it does, or as it tries to do, that its policy toward Taiwan has not changed? What's your understanding of U.S. policy toward Taiwan in this regard? Does the longstanding policy of strategic ambiguity still apply, or is the de facto policy now strategic clarity about what you've written?
I think there's been some confusion about Biden's statements and whether or not, when the State Department replies, whether it's a pullback on what he said and so on. But I don't see Biden's statement as representing a change in U.S. policy. I don't. I know many do. I think the Taiwan Relations Act clearly stated that the U.S. would see China's resort to coercion and threat of force against Taiwan to be, quote, of grave concern to the U.S. And so the TRA has not only committed to provide Taiwan with defensive arms, but also to maintain U.S. capacity to defend Taiwan, not U.S. commitment to actually go in, but U.S. capacity to do it, which is important. And in light of China's increasing, I think, aggressive actions, you know, I see Taiwan's statement as consistent with U.S. policy, which is to deter China from an invasion and support a peaceful, you know, resolution of cross-strait relations issues. You know, as for the concept of strategic ambiguity, which again is cited quite often, as I understand it, at least the concept of that of strategic ambiguity refers historically and originally and specifically to the U.S. not committing to intervene in a cross-strait conflict if it were started or provoked by the Republic of China or Taiwan. So as you know, in the past, in the 50s, there were calls for Chiang Kai-shek, President Chiang Kai-shek in the ROC, for a return to the mainland China. And in that case, I think the U.S. clearly signaled that it was not prepared to support that and risk a war to support a re-invasion of mainland China by the ROC. Similarly, I think when I was serving there years ago in under Chen Shui-bian administration, when there were, you might say, movements or calls possibly for declaring independence or moving in some ways towards that. Again, I think the concept of strategic ambiguity came in and applied in the sense that the U.S. essentially was saying that it would not risk a war with China over Taiwan if, in fact, it were provoked by the Taiwan side. But as I see it, this concept does not apply to U.S. policy in the case of China, quote, using force or other forms of coercion that would jeopardize the security or the social or economic system of the people of Taiwan, unquote, which the TRA commits the U.S. to maintain the capacity to resist. So I think today it clearly is the case that China is the one pushing the envelope in terms of its acts of intimidation against Taiwan. And so from that perspective, I think Biden's administration efforts to deter that and to state its commitment to Taiwan, I think it's not a change of a policy in part of the United States.
I think that is a very interesting and pretty unconventional interpretation in some ways of the strategic ambiguity policy, and certainly a really interesting take. But if I may, let me drill down a little bit on President Biden's statement, because I think it certainly was significant, and in the minds of many, you know, does raise the question, which you touched on, of, you know, does this constitute a change in declared policy or not? And obviously there have been some confusing signals sent around that. But here's my question. Why do you suppose President Biden draws the evident distinction that he is drawing between the Ukraine case, Russia's invasion of Ukraine on the one hand, and a possible Taiwan scenario? Both Russia and China are nuclear weapon states with intercontinental reach, and both, therefore, have the capacity to lay waste to a good swath of the United States. And that's why, in the case of Russia, we're not in direct armed conflict with Russia. And so President Biden is unwilling to commit troops to the fight against Russia, but evidently is willing to do so. That's what he says, in a possible future fight against China. So my question, Bob, is what do you think accounts for this distinction that he is drawing between going to war with Russia and not wanting to do that on the one hand, and the possibility of going to war with China and seemingly being willing to do that on the other? And let's bear in mind, the U.S. actually recognizes Ukrainian sovereignty. But as a matter of at least declared policy, the United States does not recognize Taiwan's sovereignty. So how do you explain this distinction that he's drawing?
It's a very good question, and I think a complicated question, because it's always difficult to draw, you might say, analogies and so on between different cases. But what I would say is this, you know, apart from the legal question of sovereignty and diplomatic relationship recognition and so on, of course, we have a long history of U.S. dealing with Taiwan in the context, overall context, since the 1940s. We've had a lot of other specific, you might say, developments where the U.S. made commitments in some ways under TRA, under the Six Assurances and so on. So it's a long history of our dealing with Taiwan, I think, that might be able to explain in some ways our different, you might say, commitments to Taiwan as opposed to Ukraine. But I want to go beyond that, because one can spend a long time doing that and saying whether or not that really does make a difference or doesn't make a difference. But I think the more important point, I think, for me, is the value of Taiwan itself today to the United States, to explain why we would or would not intervene in defense of Taiwan. And from that point of view, I think it's clear that to almost everybody that Taiwan today stands as a model of democracy, not only in the region, but around the world, especially as you look at the world and the declining freedoms and democracies around the world. This is very important. And clearly, I think it's a top domestic and foreign policy priority for the Biden administration and for Biden himself in particular. You can see the democracy summit that was held in the U.S. You can see in all the statements how much importance he puts on this. And of course, now with the midterm elections and all that, he came out and really put the issue of democracy to the American people as well. So this is something that is very, very important to him personally. So Taiwan, as a symbol of that, I think is important for him and makes a difference. And I think that's why he's personally stepped forward to make this commitment to Taiwan clearer to China and to the rest of the world. But beyond that, I think Taiwan, of course, as you know, is the eighth largest trading partner of the United States. Ukraine is not anywhere close to that. And of course, the trading partner, especially in high tech sectors. And we have, you know, significant investment in each other's economy. Now with Taiwan companies investing, of course, in the critical semiconductor manufacturing sector in the United States. And of course, we're getting a lot of semiconductors, advanced ones, from Taiwan. And so economically, in terms of interest, Taiwan really does, I think, mean a lot in terms of U.S. economic growth and vitality, especially in the global supply chain and regional supply chain.
Those are certainly compelling and thoughtful points. No question about that. What surprises me, just as a kind of editorial observation, is just that those kinds of considerations, if that is what is driving the distinction and accounting for the distinction that President Biden himself is drawing, that those very good and important considerations somehow outweigh the notion of nuclear deterrence. and the notion of mutual assured destruction. And that seems a little implausible to me. But the point certainly is well taken about Taiwan's economic importance and obviously the shared values and so on. So this is an interesting question, and I really appreciate your sharing your take on it.
Can I just add one more thing? Because I think apart from those two, I think perhaps just as important consideration for the United States, apart from the democracy, the values and economics and so on, is the fact that if at this point China is able to invade Taiwan successfully and so on, the concern for the United States is not just Taiwan. It is our entire alliance system in Asia that we believe will be at risk. In other words, after Taiwan, what? Senkaku, Japan, the South China Sea. So the question there is, Taiwan in some ways, I think, symbolizes for and represents, I think, for the United States much more than Taiwan itself, but also our alliance, our friends, democracies and others, Japan, Korea, et cetera, in Asia. So I think it's beyond Taiwan itself.
Bob, I think that's a very important point, and I hear what you're saying, but one certainly could make the argument that the equivalent argument would be true relative to Ukraine and Europe. Again, Ukraine is not an ally, and Taiwan is not an ally of the United States in any juridical sense. And yet you're making the point that somehow America's credibility might be diminished if we weren't to stand up for a fellow democracy and friend and so on. But one could make those arguments about the about Ukraine as well. And yet the president of the United States, the sitting president, has come to apparently fundamentally different judgments for some reason. Again, maybe relating to all the good points that you've made, or maybe what he is saying is not what the United States would actually do if this situation really unfolded and became a hot war. But in any case, it's something that I think is, if I had been Chris Wallace, I would have asked that question. I would have been very curious as to how he himself would have responded to it. But you have responded to it in a very thoughtful way. Let me ask you this, Bob. You know, Russia's unlawful, unprovoked, unjustified, and really deplorable invasion of neighboring Ukraine has prompted many observers, as you know, to wonder aloud or even posit, you know, that there is now an increased likelihood that China will soon go into Taiwan militarily. And in the wake of the summit between President Biden and President Xi Jinping, Biden himself said that he does not believe, and this echoes a point I think that you made earlier, the Chinese leadership has such intentions in any immediate sense. But my question for you, Bob, is this. Do you think the Russia-Ukraine situation has had or will have any impact on the strategic calculus or decision-making of the Chinese leadership on the matter of Taiwan? Or on the contrary, does it all just confirm what Chinese leaders have always presumed a U.S. response would look like to this type of action?
No, I think there is no question in my mind that what has happened in Ukraine is carefully watched by China. And there's no question in my mind that it has an impact on China's calculus in terms of how the U.S. would respond in the case of crisis in the Taiwan Strait, et cetera. So they're looking at that very carefully. But as I see it, the main lesson perhaps that Beijing would draw from what has happened in Ukraine in terms of its own calculus regarding Taiwan is probably ironically that it actually has increased the concerns in Beijing as to whether China can, you know, successfully launch an invasion of Taiwan. Even if there's no actual U.S. military intervention, the sanctions, the difficulty of the invasion itself in terms of the naval operations and looking at the risk of U.S. involvement, even if they cannot assure one way or the other what will happen, I think it has actually given Beijing second thoughts about whether or not or how easy or difficult an invasion of Taiwan would be. And so they're looking at that. And I think the basic bottom line probably is that it's given them a little bit more concern as to whether or not it can be successful and whether or not the U.S. will simply back down or may intervene. That's still a calculation. And for Taiwan, I think the Ukraine situation has also underscored the importance of building Taiwan's own defense capabilities. So you're seeing now consideration of lengthening the conscription. You're seeing questions of enhancing defense capabilities in terms of asymmetric defense capabilities, certain kinds of weapons that would be needed. So that's a very important point. When they look at Ukraine and how the Ukrainians themselves have stepped up, I think this really pushed a lot of people in Taiwan towards willingness to undertake a greater responsibility for their own defense.
I think that makes a lot of sense, Bob. And I would just say that I agree personally with your assessment and have made this point as well, that while the Russia-Ukraine case makes it clear that at least in that case and possibly in future similar cases, the United States would not necessarily commit troops and certainly hasn't done so with respect to Russia-Ukraine, the fact is the United States and its allies have imposed incredible costs on Russia. And I agree with you that my reading of Chinese strategic sentiment around this is that, if anything, this has deepened Chinese concerns about what the costs would be for China, even in the absence of a direct military response from the United States or others. Mm-hmm. And I do think that that lesson, if anything, is probably the key lesson that the Chinese have taken thus far from the Russia-Ukraine situation. And of course, and you alluded to this, the degree of difficulty of launching an amphibious assault is much greater than the degree of difficulty of putting tanks on a paved highway and simply driving them across a flat border. So all of those are, I think, very good points that you make. Let me ask one other question about Taiwan before we wrap up. If China were to go into Taiwan militarily in an effort to generate what it would call reunification by force of arms, how do you think the United States actually would respond? And this is very speculative, but, you know, in very broad terms, what do you think the end state of such a conflagration would be? What would things look like when all is said and done? Or at least, what are some of the scenarios? I agree with you, by the way, that I think the likelihood of conflagration across the strait anytime in the foreseeable future, I personally think is very low for all the reasons that you've mentioned. And I've made that point as well. I think it's somewhat of a counter-conventional point that we're making, because a lot of people see it differently. But what do you think the U.S. would do, and what would things look like if you were to play that scenario out?
Sure. Obviously, it's going to be very difficult to predict. What I would say is, in line with what I'd said earlier in terms of Chinese strategy, I don't think there'll be an immediate invasion, a full invasion. It's going to be a piecemeal step forward, whether it's a blockade or whether it's an island, Jinmen or Matsu or something like that. It's going to be something, I think, more incremental rather than a full invasion right away, because the Chinese don't want that. They know if they did that, the cost of that would be tremendous. And also, that's not the strategy. The strategy is to gradually, incrementally increase the pressure until you can get the United States and Taiwan to back down. They don't want a war either, but you want the United States and Taiwan to show that they would perhaps push for a compromise or a concession, a minor concession right away, rather than risk a major war. So it's going to be incremental. And so my guess is, on the side of the United States, the scenario would be, or the response would be, a gradual incremental response as well. So we're not talking about nuclear war right away off the bat. We're talking about, you know, they're pushing, testing, and the U.S. then would, my guess is, would push back in this case, especially because of under the Biden administration, the statements and commitments they've made that seem to be a departure from the, you know, previous policy, some people say. But I think there will be a response to that. And so in some ways, it will look very much like what has happened in the history of cross-strait ties, meaning if you go all the way back to 54, when mainland China under communist government wanted to retake Taiwan, and Taiwan resisted, and U.S. helped, supported Taiwan, including Jinmen and Matsu. And of course, in 1958, when China thought that they could, again, intimidate and move forward with military action. And then, of course, in 1995-96, during the Li Denghui period, when the Chinese, in response, again, also took military actions against Taiwan. U.S. responded as well with the, you know, with the carriers a little bit off, of course, to Taiwan, not actually directly fighting, but also responded incrementally. So my guess is that what will happen, if the Chinese want to push forward with their strategy, is that they will do something incremental, the U.S. will do something incremental, then we'll see what happens. In other words, at that point, at least in the past, China was not as strong, so it sort of backed off after 54, 58, 95, 96, and so on. And so my guess is that if they see that the U.S. is in fact responding, and may, not necessarily certainly will, but may respond even more, my guess is that they will back down. And they will say, okay, this is not working. Let's maybe wait for another time. a more appropriate time where, in fact, the U.S. may back down because of perhaps domestic problems or whatever else. And so that's a scenario I tend to look at. I don't see it, again, as an immediate confrontation, a major conflict right away. I see it as testing, dangerous, but I think not an immediate major conflict.
Let me just ask one last kind of bullet point question just for a quick response. I've given some talks on Taiwan recently, and one of the points that I make, and my question to you is whether you would agree or disagree with this, and to elaborate for a sentence or two. I have made the point for a long time, including recently, that the people in Taiwan will never, never voluntarily reunify with China, that the only way reunification, as China would put it, could ever occur would be by the use of force or coercion by China, that it would never occur, at least in my lifetime, of the volition of the people of Taiwan. Would you agree with that statement or disagree with it?
I would basically agree with that statement. Obviously, it depends on what happens, whether there's a full war or not full war, et cetera. And, there are different views within Taiwan. But I would say most people in Taiwan, if you ask them, I would say 70, 80, 90% of the people, they will not want to reunify Taiwan and with China, especially as what China is doing today actually further alienates the people in Taiwan. In other words, every time they launch a military exercise, incursion into Taiwan territories, what they do in Hong Kong, what they do within China, all of the things that China has been doing in the past several years has actually made it even more unlikely that anyone in Taiwan would want to voluntarily reunify with China. So I think voluntarily means, positively. Now, if there was a war, if things happen, we can't predict what not. And if the U.S. did back down, at the end of the day, will they fight to their death or will they compromise in some form? I don't know. In the case of Ukraine, clearly they're standing firm. In the case of Taiwan, I think they will certainly don't want to do that. But will they finally fold at the end if there's a major, major conflict and their lives are at stake, et cetera? I don't know. But I think that what you're saying is right, that I don't think at this point there's anyone in Taiwan, anyone, 90% of people or more in Taiwan do not voluntarily want to reunite with a China that is the way it is today within China itself.
Well, listen, this has been an incredible discussion. And Bob, thank you both for your time and your incredible insights. We really appreciate your perspective and your taking the time to join us. So thank you so much again, Bob.
Could I make a closing remark?
Yeah, of course. Please do.
What I really want to do in some ways in this podcast is the point I want to make is that, it's important for the United States and our democratic allies and partners to put the cross-strait crisis and the issue in the context of defending the values of the rules-based liberal international order and not just about avoiding conflict. I mean, I read all over, whether it's Economist magazine front page or whether it's a recent article in the Foreign Affairs, all the title regarding the crisis across the straits is how to avoid a war. Yes, it's important to avoid a war, but I think it's as important to make sure that we put it in the context of defending the rules of the liberal international order. Because we need to think, as I see it, long-term and not just focus on easing immediate tensions and achieving temporary diplomatic solutions, as many people, for example, have proposed in the case of Ukraine. Why don't just give up this place or that place and then we'll have peace? And so if we focus only on avoiding war, we lose the long-term view that I think is very important, because I really do believe that, for example, in the case of Ukraine, that a lot of the miscalculation came because there's no lack of response on the part of the U.S. and the West to the annexation of Crimea or Putin's decision in Georgia in terms of annexation of parts of the territory of Georgia. And when I looked at this, it reminds me not only of those, but also, frankly speaking, I was just in Germany in August and went to Nuremberg. And I remember seeing the document center about Nazis' rise, where, not Hitler's annexation of parts of Czechoslovakia, invasion of Poland, and of course, later on, Japanese invasion of China, as eventually leading to World War II, and with even more disastrous consequences for the world. So I guess my closing remark is that I'm worried that we keep on thinking and focusing only on stopping the current tensions, lowering it, And then we forget that when you do that, what you do is you encourage people to do other things. In the case, whether it's Hitler or whether it's Japan or whether it's China, as they do other things, then potential consequences of that will be much, much larger than being firm at this point in the case of Chinese actions across the Taiwan Strait.
Bob, I think that's a really important message, and I really appreciate your sharing that, because it does really cast the issue into a much broader context, which I think is really important for people to think about. So thank you so much for sharing that and for all the insights that you've shared today. And to our listeners, I'd just like to say, remember to look for the Bush China Foundation podcast on our website, SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, where you can follow our conversations. As always, thank you so much for listening.